Goddag og velkommen til Langsomme Samtaler. Mit navn er Rune Lykkeberg. Jeg har i den her uge talt med økonomen Isabella M. Weber, der det seneste års tid er blevet til en ny progressiv stjerneøkonom i den internationale debat. Hun har engageret sig i hele den internationale diskussion om, hvad er årsagen til inflation, hvad er inflationens kilder, hvorfor bliver den ved med at være der, hvad er begrebet sellers inflation eller greedflation, som det også er blevet kaldt, og hvordan bekæmper man bedst muligt inflation. Hun er således en økonom, der både kan det teoretiske og det praktiske. Hun har lavet videnskabelige papers, men hun har også blandet sig i den direkte politiske debat, og hun er blevet brugt som rådgiver af forskellige regeringer i deres bestræbelser på at bekæmpe inflationen. Men det, jeg har talt med Isabella M. Weber om, det er hendes bog, som er et absolut hovedværk til forståelsen af hele den kinesiske økonomi. En bog, der kom for et par år siden, der hedder How China Escaped Shock Therapy, The Market Reform Debate. Det er en bog, som går tilbage og spørger, hvorfor kan det være, at kineserne valgte en anden vej end de østeuropæiske lande og Rusland og mange andre stater efter murens fald. Den chokterapi, der blev foreskrevet som den rigtige vej fra kommunisme til markedsøkonomi, førte mange steder til staters sammenbrud, til stor ulighed, til at man skabte en lille økonomisk overklasse. Det skabte oligarkiske samfund, og det var hele tiden under løftet om, at det bliver hårdt nu, men det skal nok blive godt på lang sigt. Kina valgte en helt anden vej. Der var lange samtaler om det, der var interne såkaldte deliberationer i Kommunistpartiet i 1980'erne, om hvordan man kunne finde en gradvis vej fra en kommunistisk økonomi, der havde skabt stor fattigdom, stor ulighed, tilbagestående økonomisk og teknologisk udvikling og socialt armod i Kina. Hvordan kunne man finde en vej væk fra det og over til en økonomi, hvor man på den ene side kunne få det bedste ud af kapitalismen, samtidig med, at man kunne undgå det værste? Vi har en tendens til at forestille os det kinesiske kommunistparti som en monolit, som én stemme, der taler sammen og samlet og styrer landets økonomi suverænt. Men Isabella M. Weber gjorde det, at hun gik tilbage og interviewede mange af de økonomer, politikere og højtstående partimedlemmer, som i 1980'erne havde hele samtalen om det her. Hun redegjorde for den kinesiske økonomiske tradition, der går mange hundrede år tilbage, og hun opdagede de kilder, der er i det kinesiske system, til at foretage den slags interne samtale og til at lægge en plan fra markedsøkonomi til det, der er blevet deres form for kommunistiske kapitalisme i dag. Det er en fantastisk bog, fordi den baserer sig på empiriske samtaler og fordi den åbner op for de beslutningsveje og de processer, der er i det kinesiske system, og fordi den blotlægger de risici, der var i overgangen, men også de fordele, der var ved den overgang, de valgte. Jeg skal skynde mig at slå fast, at bogen er ikke et argument for den kinesiske vej. Det er ikke et forslag om, at den her vej skal vi alle sammen gå. Det er et meget, meget kvalificeret forsøg på at forstå det, der må være det mest interessante og spektakulære politiske og økonomiske eksperiment i vores levetid, nemlig Kina over de sidste 40 år. Her følger min samtale med Isabella M. Weber.
The minute I saw the title of your book, How China Escaped Shock Therapy, I asked myself, why didn't anyone else ask that question? Because it seemed so obvious for us growing up with shock therapy. We saw it being implemented everywhere. So I'm curious how you got the idea of answering the question that we should have thought of long ago.
Yeah, so this comes out of my own trajectory in a way. I was studying political science and economics as an undergraduate student, and I was always puzzled by how rigid economics was. I thought they had more interesting questions than political science from where I stood, but they seemed to be using the same method and the same model for pretty much everything. And then I went to study in China, and I found that at Peking University, they were studying the exact same kind of economics with the exact same kind of textbooks. And that just didn't make sense to me because I was looking around and the economy seemed so different from what I saw in Germany. So the question of what is the role of economics in this massive transformation that China has been undergoing came from that experience. And then I was trying to find a way to research that question, and I was trying to understand like what is at stake here. And through that, and also through conversations with Eastern Germans, actually, I came to think that it's really amazing that no one has talked about the economics of China's escape from shock therapy, where we have a very clear record what kind of economics underpin shock therapy. But we have basically a gigantic black box on the question of what is the economics of Chinese gradualism, which tended to be portrayed as something that comes out of mere practice without any thinking. And that just didn't make sense to me. It didn't make sense to me that anyone could go up against the powerful economics of shock therapy that had been so incredibly influential around the world without any thinking. So that was kind of the starting point for this endeavor. And this idea actually came to me pretty early on. And I then went to the New School for Social Research to study economics and to try to study different theories of economics, because I felt like I needed to be equipped with a training in the history of economic thought and a plurality of theories to be able to start tackling that question. But I also, of course, needed someone who really understood China to help me get going with this project. And I found Peter Nolan in Cambridge, who had been working on China since the late 70s. So I went to Cambridge to do the PhD that became How China Escaped Shock Therapy. And Peter had, of course, already been around in the 80s. So he knew a lot of the people who were around in the debates in the 80s. So it was an incredible opportunity to have him as my PhD supervisor to help me get started with this project. That's very much about the first decade of reform, the path-setting first decade of reform.
Your method is very interesting, also as a journalist, because you combine different sources, different types of sources. You're obviously very familiar with the theory, but then you make these interviews with people as well, people who are part of it. And it seems also there's a meta-reflection in your book. You're quite skeptical of what we could call pure theory, that you want to contrast it with empirical sources and different kinds of sources. Could you tell a little bit about the method that you chose for this book?
Yeah, so I mean, what I was really trying to find out was how economic theory and how economics plays out in practice and played out in what I consider one of the most consequential reform debates in recent history. I mean, had China taken a different path, not only China would be looking dramatically differently, but the whole world would look completely different, right? I mean, if we think about any issue from AI to climate change to the questions of the global economic order to where the World Trade Organization is at, I mean, pick your topic. And it's basically a topic that we have to take China into the picture just because of how incredibly important China has become over the last 40 years. So trying to understand how economics works out in practice, I felt like I had to talk to the people who were involved with this and to understand how they were thinking about it. Of course, 40 years had passed, right? So there's a big time difference here. And of course, you to some extent have to discount what people are saying 40 years after the fact. So I tried to use the interviews on the one hand to understand kind of the dividing lines in the debate, because even if someone forgot the precise details, they know exactly what they were annoyed by, right? Or they know exactly what really aggravated them, or they know exactly whom they were debating with. So to get kind of a sense of what were the big issues at stake, what were the big dividing lines. And then also the interviews helped me a lot to identify the sources in the 1980s that were important for the debate. So people would share articles with me, would share diaries with me, would share notes that they took at meetings with me. I mean, most remarkably, Adrian Wood, a former World Bank economist who was the chief economist on the first World Bank mission to China in the early 80s. He took meticulous notes on every meeting, on every visit that they did, which was an incredible source that no one had tapped into. So these kind of, really personal archive of people whom I interviewed, together with the interviews, where the interviews helped me to navigate this material, became kind of the core of the book. But I was interested in not just tracing who had coffee with whom, when and where, or probably I should rather say tea, who traveled when with whom. I wasn't just interested in tracing these networks of exchanges, but I was really interested in trying to understand what were the big ideas that were at stake here? What were the big ideas that were negotiated? What were the different options of how to think about transforming a whole economic system that were on the table? So in that sense, I think I am approaching this as an economist rather than as a sociologist or a cultural historian or anyone who comes from a different disciplinary training. So I was really interested in what is at stake here in terms of the economics of economic system reform.
One thing that there are several things that struck me, but I didn't know a lot about the long tradition of thinking in China, of economic thinking, which is quite paradoxical because when I was growing up in the 70s, there were a lot of people who were Maoists and who were focusing on the Chinese tradition. That was a big thing. But this Chinese tradition that goes a long way back, and you seem to have the positions, some positions established well before the modern era, and you have this doxa called the Guanxi that I didn't know anything about. How did you discover this tradition, and what did you learn from it?
Yeah, so one of the things that I took away from my interviews was that the idea that markets are something Western and are something that is introduced to China by neoclassical economists from abroad is absurd. That China, of course, has this very, very long tradition of markets. In fact, one might argue a more sustained history of markets than the West, where, of course, in the West, the ancient times played out such that the Roman Empire eventually collapsed and all of that happened, right? So you didn't have this persistent kind of market integration of the kind that you had in China. Well, of course, you also had dynastic cycles and all of that. I'm not saying it's all one big block, but still, I think if we compare the persistence, it's clear that in China you had a much more sustained history of markets. So what actually also happened in the early 80s was that people were thinking about this transformation as a transformation in the history of Chinese civilization. So they very much had this civilizational thinking as they were pondering the question of the mode of production, to use that Marxist term, that China should be transforming into. So it became clear to me that there was a connection with ancient statecraft and that they were seeing their work in relationship to China's own tradition of thinking about markets and states. That being said, it's not like any interview partner told me, oh, this was based on the Guanzi and then we had this idea. It was more like I felt there was something there and I needed to provide context to avoid the misunderstanding that marketization is the same as westernization. I then looked for possible reference points, and it was in fact my PhD supervisor, Peter Nolan, who suggested to me to read the Guanzi as a starting point. And I read it in translation. It's very difficult to read classic Chinese, but I was just blown away. I read the text and I was like, this is incredible. I had been trained in the history of economic thought. I had never heard of this text. I thought it was easily on par with Adam Smith, if not even more mind-blowing to me, because it had a completely different approach that seemed further away from what I knew from other economics training. So then I got very interested in this and started to realize that basically in economics and in the history of economic thought, this absolutely groundbreaking text that is a reference text for Chinese statecraft across centuries has basically not been considered. This is like as if we were talking about the history of the West and we had overlooked Aristotle or Plato, right? That's kind of the importance of this text in the history of Chinese thinking. So I felt like it was important to include this in my book. And as I was working through the Guanzi and as I was working through the salt and iron debate, which is this iconic debate that happens actually several centuries after the Guanzi, but still is very much related, I realized that this could actually provide some sort of a theoretical anchoring point. I wouldn't call it framework, but a theoretical anchoring point for my book, and that a lot of the issues that were debated in the 80s were very much in the kind of spirit of the Guanzi. So let me maybe make this a little bit more concrete. The Guanzi at its core, in terms of its economic theory, is about the so-called heavy and light theory, the Qing Zhong theory, where heavy and light basically stand for important, consequential, or heavy, and light for cheap, unimportant, unconsequential, or light. So that you have these two poles. But by putting this together into one word, it's actually like kind of something that might translate into a theory of balancing forces or something like that. Now, this means that as you're trying to understand the working of the economy, you have to always ask the question, what is the important thing here? What is the essential thing? What is the heavy thing that really matters for the working of the system as a whole? And all of this is written from the perspective of a dialogue between a prince and his advisor, Guan Zhong, which is also the title of this book, the Guanzi. And the prince is basically trying to understand how he's supposed to govern the economy in a context of deep structural change, as in this ancient setting, the economy was transforming from a more or less ritual order in the context of the warring states of perpetual war into a more and more market-based economy. And the prince was trying to understand how to navigate that kind of a system. So Guan Zhong insists that you have to focus on the essential, you have to focus on the important stuff. But the important stuff is not kind of statically given. It's not always the same, but it's a very dynamic concept of what is important in the context of perpetual change. So, for example, if you look at the price of grain, which is considered, generally speaking, as the most important price, since this is an agricultural economy, and therefore the value of money is highly dependent on the price of grain. But the price of grain varies over the seasons. So in fall, after the harvest, there would be a high supply of grain, which would mean that the price of grain would be relatively low. And then as the seasons progress, the price would go up all the way until summer. So this means that grain is relatively light in fall, relatively abundant, relatively oversupplied, and becomes subsequently heavier as you move to summer. Now, what the state is supposed to do in the logic of the Guanzi is to recognize that this is an objectively given pattern. This is not a matter of market distortions. This is not a matter of people being evil or whatever. This is an objectively given pattern in light of the workings of the seasons. So the ruler should observe these patterns and should observe them continuously. Actually, we have like detailed calls for collecting statistics, like 300 BC or so, right? So the ruler should be collecting statistics on harvest, on weather, in order to have a good sense of how this is, how these objectively given forces are working out in practice at any moment in time, and should then participate in the market by buying grain when it's overabundant in fall and selling grain when it is becoming scarce in spring and summer. So instead of suppressing these forces, the state should be using these forces in order to stabilize the price. But by stabilizing the price, the state would actually be extracting resources for its own fiscal revenue, since it would be buying the grain when the price is low and would be selling when the price is high, and therefore basically engaging in an arbitrage transaction. But the public granary, which is the entity that is meant to implement this, is supposed to not behave like a private merchant that would be basically like maxing this out, right? Like buying as cheap as possible and then selling as expensive as possible. The state should be buying at a somewhat lower price than it plans to sell, but it should be squeezing the peasants to the edge by buying at too low of a price. And it should be selling at somewhat higher of a price than it bought at, but it shouldn't be pushing it so that the urban population that would be dependent on gray markets would be basically pushed into poverty. So this is a balancing act where you do not erase these forces. You keep a spread, right? But you balance the price, you take out the extremes. And by balancing the price of grain, you also balance the interests of the urban consumers and the rural producers. And thereby, you actually try to work towards social cohesion. You try to satisfy the people while extracting money from them, but appearing as a benevolent state that actually ensures the provisioning of grain, that is engaged in famine prevention, and that gives farmers a higher price when they would be getting a lower price from private merchants, and consumers a lower price when they would be getting a higher price from private merchants. So it's a theory of balancing forces. It's also a deeply psychological theory of the state. The ultimate goal is to preserve the power of the state and to make the economy prosper in order to ensure the prosperity of the state and the power of the ruler. But it's very sophisticated psychological approach. You have passages that say things like, if you go around and tax instead of doing these market participation exercises, the state appears as an entity that is taking away from the people, right? It shows up and says, give me your grain, right? It shows up and says, give me your money. That is bad in that logic, right? That's what they're saying. That is bad. This will undermine the power of the ruler. This will make people hate the state. This will make people want to overturn the state, right? Whereas if you do this price stabilization granary system, people will actually be in support of the state and will perceive the state as benevolent. Now, of course, it was never like perfect. There were always issues. Once the state starts participating in the market, you do get issues of corruption. You do get challenges of how can you ensure that your officials are actually serving the interests of the public and the state and not the interests of the local granary and their own coffers, right? So you always have this tension. But still, this is kind of the logic at play here, right? And if we kind of fast forward to the 1980s, which is, of course, a gigantic jump, I think it becomes very clear in reading the documents on the 1980s that, I mean, A, this idea of when we deal with prices, we have to constantly be aware of how people perceive this has been an absolutely central idea, not least because coming out of the Maoist more or less planned economy, the state was, of course, perceived as being responsible for prices, right? So this means that if something goes wrong with prices, it's a responsibility of the state. So the state has to be absolutely conscious of how people will react to any one price change or pricing mechanism change that the state might engage in. But at the same time, the state has to understand, B, that there are areas where movement is possible. So it has to constantly assess where are the parts within the system that are light, that you can move, where you can introduce market dynamics without destabilizing the system as a whole, without aggravating people or producers. As such, I think if we read the 80s debates on the question of price reform, it's this constant balancing act of trying to introduce new forces, but introducing them in a way that you can still balance them, that you can still control them sufficiently to maintain the stability of the system as a whole. And as we know, of course, this didn't work out perfectly by any means. I mean, in 88, things almost got out of control. In 89, we got the whole political escalation and the massacre on Tiananmen Square. So I'm not saying this has been a kind of a perfect implementation of ancient wisdom or anything like that. But I just think that through these principles of what is essential, what really matters, how can we balance, how can the state participate in the market, which is a way of thinking about states and markets that is not binary. It's not the state versus the market, but it's the state can participate in markets. It can create markets. It can be a market creating, market shaping kind of an actor. In fact, the market, in a sense, is inside the state, and the state is, in a sense, inside the market. So that kind of thinking, I think, is really important in making sense of Chinese reform policymaking.
And it's very impressive when you read the book and you don't know a lot about it in advance. And I can confess, I did not know a lot about in advance that often you tend to think of countries being thrown into capitalism as they have to liberate themselves from their traditions and get ahead into some unknown form of modernity. But here there's a grounding in a tradition that kind of equips some deliberation into this capitalist experiment. There's another conflict that's prevalent in Chinese history between the intellectuals and the bureaucrats, between the literati and the practitioners, which is very, very interesting that you have this very long tradition of that, because it's not, as you describe it in the book, that they get the final result out of their tradition, then they just implement it. You have different positions also in the process in the 80s. Could you tell a little bit about this conflict between the literatis and the bureaucrats?
Yeah, thank you so much for bringing this up. Absolutely. So this was also something that I found really important, to not only say China has this long tradition of statecraft, of not only thinking, but also practicing and governing markets, where the granary system is probably the most prominent and in some sense most interesting example. But also China has this very long history of debates, right? Of very foundational debates on the questions of the relationship between the market and the state, how to govern the economy, what should be the role of private actors, what should be the role of public actors, and so on. So the so-called salt and iron debate is in a way the classic statement of exactly that confrontation. And it's a debate that, if you actually go read it, reads almost a little bit like what we sometimes portray as the debate between Keynes and Hayek, where of course there never was like such a condensed debate between Keynes and Hayek, but nevertheless, like the positions that we think of in terms of Keynes and Hayek, I think are in some ways similar to the salt and iron debate, just like about two millennia earlier or so. Now, this is a situation where basically there had been a liberalization of a lot of these bureaucratic governance mechanisms under Emperor Wen Di, and then Wu Di took over at a time when inflation was very high, when the fiscal situation was very bad, the state was running out of money and was engaged in warfare. So that there was a question of what one could do to overcome inflation and like re-stabilize public finance. And what they did was to revive these principles of state market participation, not only for grain, but also for a range of important goods. For example, salt, iron, just to give two more examples. So then based on the evidence that we have, seemed to have helped to overcome the inflation and fiscal crisis. And when Emperor Wu Di passed away, there was a kind of a great inquiry into the economic policies of Emperor Wu Di, and they were assessing whether to continue with this course or whether one should be somehow changing the economic policy paradigm. They are not talking about paradigms, but I think that's basically what it is. Now, on the one hand, you have Sang Hongyang, who was a merchant, merchant bureaucrat. So that was actually also an interesting situation, because merchants had given credit to the state, and then the state brought in these merchants to help solve the fiscal crisis. And since these merchants were important creditors, they had an interest in rescuing the state's finances. So this is a little bit maybe like the IMF or the World Bank today, just that these were private entities. And they had a much more pragmatic stance than what we would commonly attribute to the Bretton Woods institutions as creditors. In any case, Sang Hongyang was a defender of Moody's economic policies, arguing that state market participation was necessary to stabilize the economy, and that in certain areas of the economy, there would be what we would call today natural monopolies. So, for example, in iron ore is concentrated in the mountains. So it's found in concentrated places. So it's not a matter of whether someone will monopolize iron ore, but it's a matter of who will monopolize iron ore. So if it's not the state doing it, then it would be private merchants doing it, which would mean that the balance of power between the private and the public would be tilted towards towards the private. Now, the so-called literati, which were basically Confucian scholars, where Confucian is a very broad term and can mean a lot of things. But in any case, they were scholar bureaucrats, so they were trained in the classics. And they were appealing to the moral order of rights and were arguing that if the state starts to meddle in the economy, starts to participate in markets, then the state would inevitably become corrupt and would lose its moral integrity. So instead of meddling between the boundaries of the state and the market, the state should pursue a laissez-faire, a wu-wei kind of a policy, so should take a step back and should instead appeal to the moral integrity of the private actors. And so in that sense, this is a bit like laissez-faire as we would be thinking of it today, just that you do not yet have the invisible hand that would turn any pursuit of private profit into public benefits, right? So you do not yet have what Duncan Foley calls the Adam's fallacy, where what private selfishness translates into public virtue, but you still have an appeal to private virtuousness in order to achieve public virtuousness. But if the state manages to reestablish a ritual order that ensures that people are behaving in this morally integral kind of way, then the state should not be engaged in all this meddling with the economy. Now, at the end of the day, I think that a lot of the issues that are being discussed here are issues that are very contemporary, in the sense that the question of whether distortions, whether undesirable phenomena in an economy emerge from the state's intervention, or kind of a matter of fact of the ways in which the economy works, and it's a question of how you deal with these problems rather than blaming them on the state's actions, I think is an issue that, I mean, we see everywhere, basically, right? And so this is the classic salt and iron debate. And I think in many ways it resonates with the debate in the 1980s. We're on the side of the gradualist reformers. You have people who were arguing that one should use the state entities. I mean, coming out of the Maoist economy, China was, of course, by and large, an economy that was managed by state and collective and commune entities, right? So basically public entities. So the question was, do you have to abolish these institutions, right? Do you have to tear them down in order to make space for the market to emerge like Phoenix out of the ashes? Or are you using these entities as market creators, as your vehicles, as your institutional infrastructure to actually create a market economy? And I think that the latter stance is very much in the spirit of the Guanzi, or in the spirit of a Sun Hongyang, and that the earlier stance, to some degree, is a bit similar to the literati, just that, of course, in the literati kind of framework, you also need all this ritual work, you also need all this work towards moral integrity and so on. So you cannot just rely on the good thing emerging from chaos out of nothing, right? So I'm not saying it's one-to-one, but I think there is a certain similarity. I think there's also a certain similarity in the sense that those people who in the 1980s we're arguing for some sort of a shock liberalization of prices, which is one of the key elements of shock therapy, came from neoclassical economics, or sometimes also from Marxist economics, interestingly, thinking about the economy as one big closed system with a set of consistent principles, rather than coming from this this approach of saying, yes, there are some laws of motion, or however you want to call them, like there are some first order principles, but the ways in which they are playing out in practice, it's something that we have to constantly observe and constantly manage and constantly attend to in a kind of very discretionary kind of way, right? So those who were coming from this system as a whole, axiomatic, starting from first principles kind of approach, tended to think that you had to move from one complete system to the next complete system. And in order to do that, you needed to have kind of a planned approach of how you get from one system to the next. And whether this is done in several distinct shocks or whether this is done in one big shock, it's kind of a matter of detail. But the point is that you know the target system that you're trying to move to. You know all characteristics of your current system, and you can, by theoretical derivation, define the steps that you need to take to get from A to B. Whereas the gradualist statecraft kind of reformers were basically saying, we know broadly where we want to go, right? Like the first goal is to develop the economy. China at the time was, of course, a very, very poor country, even though during the Maoist period, there was substantial progress on, for example, public health, public education, and so on. But still, it was a very, very poor country, right? Actually, with the beginning of reform, there was a shift from the Cultural Revolution principles of saying politics is in command, to economics is in command. So we need to first develop the forces of production, to use the Marxist language that they were using at the time. We have to first develop the economy. And once we develop the economy, we can move towards higher forms of socialism. So this latter approach of the economy first was something that was shared by both reform camps. But the first camp thought that there was a very clearly defined target model that one could derive from theoretical principles. And the second camp, I think, thought that there was a pretty clear direction that they wanted to go. There were clear goals, like by year so-and-so, we want to achieve this and that living standard. We want to eradicate poverty in that way. We want to have these and these capacities or whatever. So there were like specific goals, but how you get to these goals, how to cross the river, as they were saying, should be done by feeling for stones. So should be done step by step, where at every step along the way, you are trying to unleash these new dynamics and then channeling them, but you don't quite know yet where you will get at, but you are trying to do your best at every step along the way. Now, one simplistic way of distinguishing the two is to say that the target system-oriented approach is akin to shock therapy, and the feeling for stones across the river approach is akin to gradualism. But in fact, I used this language myself earlier, but in fact, I think it's to some extent confusing in the sense that the dividing line between the two is not really gradualism, as in taking it three steps or four or five or 10 steps, but the dividing line is a different logic of thinking about how you're changing an economic system, where, the first approach could be quite gradual if you're taking the steps pretty slowly, right? I would argue that in the 80s, there were strong voices that were akin to Big Bang type of thinking, where you were thinking that you should shock liberalize a set of core prices. Whereas the second approach would say you have to keep the core stable and start from the periphery. So there's a difference in terms of, do you start from the core of the system or do you start from the periphery of the system? But even the feeling for stones to cross the river approach can be quite radical. It's not necessarily soft or like, you know, like, I mean, slow. If you at the, if you look at the agricultural reform, which was the breakthrough reform for Chinese marketization in the 80s, it did follow this kind of feeling for stones across the river approach in the sense that in the first instance, the production quotas were continued. So every locality had a production quota for, let's say, grain that they had to produce under the national or provincial plan for grain production. So this quota was maintained in the first instance, which meant that the grain distribution and production system was maintained in the first instance. But the responsibility, who was going to deliver this grain quota, was now moved from production teams in the communes to households, who, if once they had fulfilled their share in the quota, could produce for the market. So in that sense, I think if you define the quota in the national grain system as the heavy part, then this was kept in place. And the light part is whatever they can produce above the quota, above what is necessary. And that was liberalized. They could produce for the market. So in that sense, this fits the description of feeling for stones across the river. It fits the description of this distinction between heavy and light. It fits the description of state market participation, because the same institutions that previously were just administrating voters now actually in some cases also became commercial entities that bought some of the excess grain and marketed it in other locations. But it's still a very radical reform, because at the end of the day, this meant the end of the communes, and the communes were the institutional base of the Maoist system, which was predominantly an agricultural system, right? So in that sense, it is very radical. It did lead to very radical, very rapid change, but it starts from a different kind of logic of managing this transformation. I don't know if this is too abstract, but
it's very, very clear. Actually, I have time for one last question, which is, when reading your book, it's obvious that there's a deliberative space within the leadership of the party, and there's an exchange of ideas. There's a collective decision-making progress. There's a responsiveness to ideas, and a huge responsiveness to the population. But if we look at the Chinese regime today, it seems that it's more like a one-man rule, and there's less of a collective decision-making process. It seems there's more focus on regaining political control over the economy than finding the balance that they were finding in the 80s. I know this is a big question, but your book begs it. How do you see the shift in what was in the period you're describing to what we're seeing today?
Yeah, I mean, the 1980s was a very tumultuous period in China. It was a period in which, I would argue, the future path was generally open, right? Like, things could have gone quite differently. This was a period when some of the main protagonists that I'm researching and whose views I'm sharing in the book were not even members of the party, right? You have people like Wang Xiaoqiang, who was going on several trips with Prime Minister Zhao Ziyang and was in that sense directly advising Prime Minister Zhao Ziyang, who was not even a party member yet when he started his work, right? That is a kind of inconceivable today, and is in part result of this chaotic situation at the beginning of reform coming out of the Cultural Revolution, where a lot of the reform leaders themselves were actually sent to the countryside, which sounds kind of romantic, but in many cases meant being basically sent to some sort of labor camps, right? So, or at least being far removed from power, right? I mean, there were different situations, but they certainly had basically their political careers broken for a couple of years. And the young reformers that emerged in the 1980s were also sent to the countryside. They were basically urban elites, young urban elites, who were sent to the countryside to work in the villages, because the idea was that the urban elites should not be detached from the reality of the majority of Chinese who are living in the countryside, right? So these two groups both came back more or less at the same time, so that you suddenly had this alliance between young and older reformers that was quite unique. And that was, in many ways, not designed or whatever. I think it was really by historical accident, or it's a kind of an irony of Mao's policy, right? That in some sense, by trying to have them re-educated from the peasants, he created this very strong reform alliance. So this, all of this was a very unique kind of setting. And for sure, this time is long gone. When I was doing the interviews in 2016, 2017, many of my interview partners were already pointing out to me that this openness of debate, as it happened in the 1980s, is very clearly a matter of the past. And I shall add that I think today, it would be much, much more difficult to do the kind of research that I did back then, to have these kind of very open conversations on questions of the 1980s, in some cases on questions that directly pertain to Tiananmen. Of course, these conversations were in private, but nevertheless, they were taking place. And I was a foreign researcher trying to understand what was going on, and by all means, a total outsider, right? So that is certainly the case. I would also argue that for sure, there is much more concentration of power of one faction within the Chinese party than there has been in a while. All of that being said, and not to downplay the power concentration that has occurred, one also has to keep in mind that within the Chinese system, there is a lot of debate that happens within the party, and that happens in ways that is invisible to the outsiders, right? So there are all these channels of communication where, for example, as a researcher, you can submit papers with policy ideas or policy proposals, or also theoretical concepts to certain channels within the party that then, if they are considered valuable, will be handed up. But these proposals might never see the light of the day. Like, as an outside observer, you will never even see that this happened. And when we see these big slogans coming out, like common prosperity, like dual circulation, you name it, ecological civilization, it's often portrayed in the media as, in the Western media, as vague, vacuous, pure propaganda. Within the system, it means it's sending a strong signal to everybody who is involved in policy questions that these are issues of priority that haven't been solved yet. So this is kind of a call for input, which doesn't mean that this input is going to be processed in a purely meritocratic or purely democratic or whatever way, but it will unleash a deliberation within the system that is often hard to see from the outside. And to what degree this is, and of course, this is much more bureaucratized, much more hierarchical, much more regulated than it was in the 80s. I mean, no comparison. But I think it's very hard to understand that part in a contemporary sense from the outside. And it's very hard for us to judge to what degree this is in which ways this is going on. Also, if you hear speeches by Xi Jinping, we might think like, oh, this is a speech that Xi Jinping came up with while he was going for a walk or something. In reality, these speeches are written by often more than 100 authors, right? So basically, there's a process of condensing messages, a process of arriving at certain consensus points that goes through many, many layers within the party hierarchy that is a compromise between different factions and so on. This is all, just for context. I'm not trying to challenge that there has been an increasing concentration of power and so on, but I think it's important to keep in mind that there's a lot of these deliberative processes going on within the party, yes, in a very hierarchical and from the outside, very obscure way, but nevertheless, this is happening, and we often don't see it and aren't even aware of of its existence. That being said, my sense is that as we are observing these intense tensions between the US and China, this, I think, also leads to a closing up of spaces within China. It means that it strengthens the hawks, it strengthens the more nationalist forces, it strengthens the people who might have said for a while, never trust the American imperialists, right? So it strengthens forces within China that will make sure to also close certain spaces, right? And they are closing these spaces, and we can see this. So this has very real repercussions for what can be said in China, what cannot be said, and so on. So I am actually quite worried about that dynamic, where I feel that this geopolitical context is kind of feeding into a dynamic that certainly was there before, but that is at the end of the day closing off a lot of space that I think was there even not that many years ago. Maybe one more comment, which is, so if we look at the actual economic policy making, I think it's important to keep in mind that while of course it's not the 1980s, it's not that kind of chaotic, open-ended type of moment by any stretch of the imagination. At the same time, I think that this experimentalist, pragmatist approach to trying to find solutions to very concrete problems, taking it one step at a time, is still ingrained in the bureaucratic system and is something that we can certainly observe also in the contemporary context under, of course, a very different environment than compared to the 80s.
Well, thank you so much. This is maybe the biggest political experiment in our time, and you've given us so much more insight into it and the tradition and the background, the ideas background. Such a pleasure reading your book. Thank you for your work and getting the chance to talk to you. Thank you, Isabella Weber.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to have a chance to introduce some ideas in the book to a Danish audience, and this has been the perfect opportunity. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Bye.
Det var min samtale med Isabella M. Weber, og den bog, vi talte om, hedder How China Escaped Shock Therapy. Isabella M. Weber er professor i økonomi ved University of Massachusetts Amherst. Samtalen her var redigeret og sat sammen af vores gode ven og helt vidunderlige hjælper Albert Kuhlmann. I næste uge, der skal jeg tale med den iransk fødte mellemøstforsker Asif Bayat. Han blev meget berømt, da han for et par måneder siden skrev et offentligt klageskrift mod Jürgen Habermas forsøg på at redegøre for, hvordan man skulle forstå konflikten i Gaza. Det var en stemme, en intellektuel stemme, som holdt Habermas fast på hans egen universalisme, når han selv svigtede den. Asif Bayat er født og opvokset i Iran. Han så, hvordan den iranske revolution fandt sted. Han har studeret det arabiske forår, han har set revolutioner finde sted, og han har også set dem falde sammen efterfølgende. Det er ham, vi taler med i næste uge, og jeg håber, I vil lytte med der også. Mit navn er Rune Lykkeberg. Tak fordi I lyttede med i dag.